It is, we have a quorum, so I think we can get started. Representative Saylor moves the minutes from our last meeting. Any discussion on them? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails, minutes are approved. Today, folks, we're going to do an overview of some of the basic issues regarding telecom that we might see during the session. And we're real fortunate to have with us today Steve Kelly from the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the U of M Humphrey Institute. And with no further ado, I think we'll turn it over to Mr. Kelly and let him present his information to us.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the invitation to be here this morning. And the presentation that I'm going to do was one that I provided to the statewide broadband task force that the governor and the legislature established. And in the course of that, some folks thought it would be useful to provide some of the same background to the committee. Many of you know much of this already, so I think its value is
to try to get everyone at a similar level and raise some questions. And Mr. Chairman, it's certainly okay with me if members want to stop me for questions as we go along. However you would like to proceed.
Yep, that's satisfactory. We'll do that.
So just a quick, the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota has as its mission to improve people's lives by advancing the application of science and technology to solve public problems. And we cover a range of things, only a little bit of which relates to information technology. I'll start with talking about telephone regulation. The federal government regulates interstate communications and has left to the states the regulation of communications within the state, telephone communications within the state. Until the 1980s, telephone was a regulated monopoly, and price, quality of service, and the availability of telephone service was all part of the regulatory scheme. More recently, we've tried patterns of alternative regulation aiming at price caps rather than specific price tariffs that companies have to pursue to provide a little flexibility. But one of the key features of telephone regulation was the goal of universal service, that everyone in the United States would have access to telephone service, and the country was actually pretty successful at achieving that. In Minnesota, we had before cell phones and young people dropping regular landlines for cell phone lines, we had about 98% penetration of telephone service. And one of the ways that we achieved that was to impose on companies a duty to serve particular areas. And so if your service territory included certain customers who were expensive to serve, the Public Utilities Commission could say you have to run a line out there. And another feature of that regulated system was that the telephone companies were treated as common carriers, a concept that came from railroad regulation and further historical precedent that basically said that the telephone company couldn't distinguish among its customers. It couldn't practice discrimination. It had to be the common carrier and accept all comers. And the state has imposed a variety of ways of collecting revenue, including sales tax and assessments for universal service and for public safety. And regulation tends to vary by acronym. Incumbent local exchange companies is sort of the broadest category of the existing telephone companies. And then included in the category of an incumbent local exchange company are the RBOCs, or the regional Bell operating companies that were part of the breakup of AT&T, and Qwest is both an ILEC and an RBOC because it's an incumbent local exchange company. We also treat large providers, those who have 50,000 access lines or more, or in excess of 50,000 access lines, differently from small providers who are mostly rural and have a lesser degree of regulation. And the smaller providers are a mix of forms that include private, cooperative, and then some municipally owned local exchange companies. So this is hard to get in a format big enough, but I think you can determine from the colors that it's hard to generalize about Minnesota because we have so many different, we have the larger companies and then roughly 90 smaller providers. And that means that across Minnesota in the telephone sector, it's a patchwork. Some companies have invested heavily in the infrastructure and have fiber to the home. Others less so. And it's one of the challenges about regulation of telephone companies in Minnesota is that it's hard to do something that works on a statewide basis because there's so much variation on a geographic basis. And that's true not just with respect to telephone, but also with respect to cable TV service. Universal service only applies to voice telephone service. And one of the public policy reasons justifying that goal were common good arguments related to safety, so that wherever you were in the state, you could reach public safety officials, called Dial 911 as that service developed, and economic development, that having telephone everywhere meant that customers could reach providers and that businesses could promote their products. So in order to help achieve universal service, the federal government created a universal service fund, and that tends to support what are called high-cost companies, that is, companies who most of whose customers are tend to be a long distance away from the central office and therefore higher cost to serve. And Qwest, for example, because so many of its customers are in metropolitan areas, is not eligible on the whole for Federal Universal Service Fund contributions. Smaller companies are. We also have explicit subsidies for low income and customers with disabilities. And then we have a system of implicit or hidden subsidies. Among those hidden or cross subsidies are long distance to local, that the access charges that customers pay through their long distance bills tend to be higher than the actual cost of providing that long distance service. And the cost then is a benefit to the local telephone company for providing that access to the long-distance company. So there's also a metropolitan to rural cross-subsidy. We impose a uniform price regulation on Qwest, so any customers that Qwest has that are higher than its average cost get a subsidy from those customers that are lower cost. And when you think about it, in Hopkins, for example, there are several apartment buildings that are not very far away from the Qwest central office. Those customers, because they're dense and are short distance away, are relatively cheap to serve compared to any Qwest customer who's at the outer edge of a regional center in greater Minnesota or might be a rural customer. So there is that kind of cross subsidy. And then business to residential, we permitted local telephone companies to charge much higher prices to businesses. And in a competitive environment, all of those hidden subsidies are at risk. For example, as new entrants, competitive local exchange companies come into the business market, it reduces the surplus that comes from those business customers that can subsidize residential customers. And so one of the challenges as we've moved to a much more competitive telecommunications market is that some of these cross subsidies have been reduced, and it's put pressure on the providers. And then the Universal Service Fund, as I said, you know, provides a, and it is not a hidden subsidy, it's an explicit one, helps high-cost companies, and it also includes subsidies to schools, libraries, and hospitals for purchasing higher-speed service since the Clinton administration. There are payments to government that include sales and corporate income tax, property taxes for the plant and equipment, and then Universal Service Fund contributions, and in Minnesota, the Lifeline subsidy for TAP and for TAM is, there's a separate one for each of them, and then the largest one is the public safety charge that goes for the 911 service and has also then been extended to the public safety radio system. Wireless has become a much bigger factor in everybody's lives in various ways, and cellular phone is subject primarily to federal regulation. There's a small space in which states can try to do something. Minnesota took a shot at regulating some of the terms of service, and the federal court overturned that, saying that it was too close to being price regulation, which states were not permitted to engage in. And cities and counties have a limited say on tower cell tower location, subject to the provisions of federal law. And then you have, besides the cellular telephone, you have the less regulated wireless services like Wi-Fi and then the developing WiMAX service that are used primarily by computers. But you know, now that you have phones that are equipped with that enable you to access both a cellular network and a Wi-Fi network. In order to achieve regulatory similarity across voice communications, the 911 charges, the public safety charges, are applied to the wireless. Cable television is they're in a bit of a predicament. They've got regulation at the federal, state, and local level. And Minnesota uses a city-based model with some cities forming multi-city commissions. And some states have adopted state-level franchise models. There's no price regulation over cable television service, and there's no universal service or common carrier requirement applicable to cable TV. There is an area served requirement in local franchises that is consistent with state law. And cities issue franchises. The franchise fee payments can be up to 5% of gross revenues, and the actual fee collected varies across the state. Cities in the metro area, on the whole, have been more successful at charging the full 5%, and other cities, in order to get cable TV providers to enter their community, ended up negotiating prices that were fees that were somewhat less than 5%. So that varies across the state as well. And the quality of service is regulated by the city or the local commission that's charged with the regulation. And another part of the cable TV city relationship is that many cities have negotiated institutional networks in which the cable TV provider provides the connection among city facilities. Fire stations, police stations, public works offices, and some of them include in the institutional network schools that are in the city as well. So that's, as you look at this relationship between the cable companies and cities, you have to be careful not to leave out the institutional networks. And then the public education and government TV channels is subject to regulation by the local city or the commission, and they one of the issues with respect to new entrants, or prospect of new entrants in the cable TV market, is what would be the area served by the new entrant, because back when cable TV entered, the city franchises the cities were concerned that all of the customers in the city would get the service. So there are requirements that say that it has to be accessible to every residential customer. There's no legal monopoly, and to a certain extent, there have been financial and other barriers to entry. So in many cities, there is an arguable monopoly in fact, even though it's not a legal monopoly, though there are questions about the competitive force that, for example, satellite-provided cable TV provides in competition with land-based television services. Some other states have adopted state-level franchises. Those have been pushed by the telephone companies, particularly by AT&T and Verizon, who have been building out their fiber-to-the-home type networks. And those state franchise options try to address the local city franchise fee, the PEG channels, and area served in a variety of ways. There's a proposal underway go this direction in Minnesota, and we're doing a study which we hope to have done in January, but it may be a little later than that. Satellite TV and internet, since we're talking about interstate communications, satellite is subject to federal regulation and competes in certain ways with cable, but they're not in a position to provide the kind of two-way communication that cable TV companies have, who are now offering voice or internet, two-way internet service. It's a good question. You could make a case on both sides, and I've heard it made on both sides, about whether satellite TV and cable TV are competitive across the range of services. I think you could say that certain services provided by those companies are subject to competition, but not all services. And it's certainly an advantage as a provider in rural area and is subject to the state sales tax. The internet is subject to federal regulation because it's classified as an information service, not a telecommunications or cable TV service. There's no common carrier obligation on internet providers, and internet service providers are subject to the sales tax, and certain schools, libraries, and rural hospitals benefit from the federal subsidy. The FCC is looking at the issue of service rules. Net neutrality has come up as a topic. It is an issue for federal regulation, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The still prevailing federal regulatory act is the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and it breaks this area down into three kinds of service: telecommunications service, cable, and information service, which includes electronic publishing. And these are legacy definitions that go back to the 1980s or before, so they don't address very well the convergence of all these different kinds of things with one service provider. And ISPs, internet service providers, are classified as information services. We have providers now who are providing all three kinds. Non-discrimination is going to continue to be a policy challenge, I think, both at the state level and at the federal level. On the telephone side, there's the heritage of having the common carrier approach, and it's applicable only to telcos with respect to their traditional services, not to newer services. The FCC and the courts have upheld that common carrier obligation doesn't apply to the newer high-tech kinds of services that a telephone company can provide. And cable companies and cellular companies can exclude other providers. So, for example, an internet service provider, if you get your internet service over your telephone line, you have a choice of internet service provider. So, I use Quest as my phone company, but I have a different internet service provider than Quest. But if you get your internet service through the cable company, the cable company provides both the line and the service. So that's a key difference. And then another role to remember with respect to government is what it can do as a purchaser. So back in the 1990s, the state was interested in making sure that schools and libraries had access to high-speed internet. And so we set up telecommunications access grants, these educational facilities and libraries could play a role in promoting the development of telecommunications for private customers, because the local provider knew that there was an anchor tenant for any investment in higher grade switching capacity that they'd install in their local office. So there really was a period of time where state government purchases were accelerating the deployment of higher speed services in parts of Minnesota. And one of the questions is, you know, is that a tool that could be used again to take us up to the next level? And then state law does provide for city ownership and operation of telecommunications companies with a supermajority vote. And that applies specifically to telephone service. A couple of odd ducks that you might want to know about. In the 1996 Telecommunications Act, there's a provision that provides for an open video system. And there was a lot of encouragement in the 1996 Act for cable TV companies to get into the telephone business. And there wasn't as strong a set of incentives for telephone companies to get into the cable TV business. But there was this provision for an open video system. And the concept was that a company would provide the infrastructure for an open video system and be subject to less regulation, provided that it made two-thirds of its capacity available to competitive service providers. So, for example, if a telephone company added video service to its system, leaving aside a whole bunch of other regulatory issues, the theory was it would be subject to less regulation as long as other content providers, other kinds of service providers, could use that higher-speed network, the video network as well. And a few Minnesota companies tried to take advantage of it, and Minnesota courts declared that the federal provision didn't override state law with respect to cable TV services. So the Congress tried to provide for a notion of less regulation at the federal level, but it wasn't clear about what the interplay would be with state law. And then the legislature took a run at another possible way of promoting greater access by providing that telecommunications purchasing cooperatives could cut deals with telecom providers with somewhat less regulatory restriction. Some folks have explored using that, but it never, so far as I know, hasn't ever come together in Minnesota. It's been explored a couple times, but has not worked out, I think, the way folks hope. Congress and the FCC haven't set clear rules on internet service and the question of discrimination. I want to distinguish a couple things here. There's a limited role for the state, but I think it's helpful for policymakers to be clear about the issue. Because of capacity concerns, certain internet companies attempted to restrict the flow of information through certain entities. And BitTorrent, which is a big file sharing entity, was one of those. And so the target was a particular customer, and the issue was system capacity. And similar things happen with internet service provided to individual customers. Companies are trying to put caps on the number of bits that you can move through your system on a monthly basis as a way of ensuring that the capacity doesn't get overused. There's no clear authorization for that, it's a reasonable, practical question, as customers are moving more and more to downloading movies and other kinds of things, it raises interesting questions about are they controlling one form of content while they're selling, all these other movies over the cable service. And so I think the FCC has some big challenges about that. Now, this is not to say that at some point the United States shouldn't have some system where people pay a little bit more for moving higher capacity. I do think we have a real challenge in thinking about how to finance ever more capacity. But the issue here is picking out particular, targeting particular customers as opposed to targeting, sort of volume across a range of customers. So I think there's some challenges there in terms of quality of service and pricing and volume caps. So looking ahead a little bit, one of the questions is broadband now the kind of public good that merits it being treated the way we treated telephone service in terms of setting a goal for universal service in broadband? And I think that's a tricky public policy question. But when you think about the kinds of services that people take for granted now that are so dependent on widely available broadband service, I think this is a real challenge for policymakers. And if you do, if you and other policymakers do decide that it is that broadband, really high-speed communication service is a subject to, or should be subject to, universal service requirement, then you have to remember how the kinds of subsidies that we had just for voice service, and that it would be hard to get to a universal service system without some system of subsidies, either implicit or explicit. And then another policy question related to this is overall subsidies. For example, things like the Universal Service Fund that go to the company as compared to the kind of specific customer-directed subsidies that are represented by TAP and TAMP. So there are choices about how to do this subsidy. Do you do it to the provider or do you do it to the customer? And then triple play providers are regulated at multiple levels, which can be a significant public policy issue in terms of inconsistency and transaction costs and a variety of other things. And so I think that's another issue that certainly the legislature, as sort of the middle layer in some of these regulatory things, needs to pay attention to.
Just to be clear, Mr. Kelly, could you just for folks say what triple play is, what a triple play provider is?
So the marketing that companies have done with respect to triple play, it's voice, video service, and data. And included in the voice often is the both local and long distance. We all have this temptation, we'd rather pay one bill than three bills. So also there's an advantage with the triple play is that you end up with some cross-subsidy from the less regulated service to your ability to earn a profit if you're price-restricted on another part of your service. So there are advantages to this. Now the other thing, it's hard to, I don't know if there have been studies of this, but the triple play raises a different kind of cross-subsidy concept, and that is that entertainment would subsidize other uses of the telecommunications network. So that, when we were thinking about business subsidizing residential before, oftentimes you'll hear this argument that, well, I have a bunch of senior citizens who are not heavy net users, and why should they... how are we going to make this affordable to them? And one way that we might be able to do that is that there are a number of other users that are heavy entertainment users, and if we as companies realize the benefits of that, there may be a hidden cross subsidies that enables the provision to less intense users of the non-entertainment service. Now, I think one of the challenges for the federal government and a place where the state should be mindful of a constructive role it can play is that for many things, the FCC is way too distant. And so dealing with individual consumer complaints has tended to be handled at the city or state level. And as the technology changes and everything becomes, you know, not just interstate but global, there'll be this tendency to say we should have more consistency across more jurisdictions and move the regulatory power higher up. And that poses a challenge for customers who have these individual problems that have to be resolved. Where do they go to do that? You know, trying to call somebody in Washington to solve the problem in your neighborhood in Maple Grove, probably too far away. And so I think both the federal government and the states, as they work with cities as well, have to think about where are these kinds of issues going to be handled in a better designed regulatory system. There are advantages to national uniformity, but that's just one disadvantage. And I think states and cities are going to have a lesser regulatory role as technology continues to change. Chairman, I'd be happy to stop. I'm going to add one more thing. I think we also have to pay attention to the continuing destabilizing effect of technology change. If I think about the last few months, Netflix is now providing thousands of movies to people who have TiVo boxes and other kinds of, and including gaming boxes, connected to their TVs. That's going to present an interesting competitive challenge to the cable TV companies that may or may not destabilize the business model that they've been able to rely on up to now. The Apple iTunes service, where you can, you get to unbundle the CD and buy individual songs. When you think about cable TV, it's this massive bundling service where you bundle multiple channels with a whole variety of content together and pay a relatively significant monthly fee for this huge bundle. Folks have stopped buying music bundled, not stopped completely, but music bundled in CDs and have bought the unbundled songs on iTunes and other kinds of services. So what does that tendency in human behavior and technology change mean for cable TV and other kinds of services? YouTube has, in some ways, a lot more content on it than public and educational and government channels do. And when you think about, for example, the way the legislature behaves, I would bet that a lot more people are accessing the legislature on streaming video than they are on cable TV now. And so you have this rapid change in ways that people get take their content, and I think that's going to challenge the business models that a lot of companies have taken for granted, and I think that's going to present policymakers, not necessarily this year, but in the foreseeable future, with some interesting challenges about how do you continue to ensure that a wide range of citizens have access to the technology that will add convenience or education or access to government services to their lives. So the challenges haven't gotten any less, they've just gotten more interesting. Chairman?
Thank you very much for that presentation and numbers. Mr. Kyle, be providing the overview that you have just seen to Mr. Reich here, and he'll email it to you. You can have that for your take a look at and review and I think that'll be helpful since there's a lot of information contained therein. But any questions or comments members would like to make? Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Kelly, it's good to see you here again. And I also wanted to ask, though, does the legislature, in your opinion, need to take an action, or is this sometimes where you let the market develop and see how things go? You know, sometimes we can kind of mess it up instead of allowing what the consumer wants to interface directly with the provider. So we let them, especially when it's moving fast, government is more designed for a different kind of benefit.
Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, congratulations on your election. There's certainly a balancing act. And one of the interesting things about telecommunications is that we do in Minnesota have examples of government-provided both telephone and cable TV. So we don't have a pure system in Minnesota, pure private sector. We have this mix. And we also have situations where the private sector has not invested at a rate that citizens or their elected officials thought was meeting the economic development or educational needs of the community, and so they did go to the voters and get authorization to create a publicly provided service. And in some communities, that's been successful. In others, it hasn't worked out as the way they'd hoped. But I think there's going to be this ongoing challenge. Another way to look at this separation, you have a physical layer, the wires that go to people's homes, that are somewhat analogous to roads. And then you have a variety of services that are provided over the wires or over the airwaves on that infrastructure. And companies, for a variety of reasons, have been reluctant to separate the profit that comes from the physical provision of service and providing the service. And that's kind of smart because content has got a higher value now. So one of the risks or possibilities is that the profit from just owning the wires is too low, and that might end up being something that's appropriate for the government to do and have a variety of private sector competitive service providers. There's a city in Sweden that adopted that approach where it built a fiber to the home network and basically said this is the network, and companies have started to migrate their services to that publicly owned network. Now that, whether that, I think that people have to watch these different models and see what works, but I don't know that there's an inherent objection to the city, for example, to a city owning the wires and making them available to service providers, but it's a complex thing. In Monticello, they concluded that they couldn't make that finance arrangement work, that the city had to provide both the physical infrastructure and a set of services in order to make the payments on the system.
Senator Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kelly, I'm thinking of just several different utilities like water and electric. Several cities, my city has electric service that it provides. I'm trying to think of one where a city owns the telecommunications infrastructure as well. Does any come to mind or off the top of your head? Because it's an interesting concept you just raised.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, Mr. Haar might actually know the but Minnesota does have, I want to say, three or four municipally owned telephone companies where they provide both the service and, you know, own the infrastructure. I can't remember which cities they are.
Okay.
The other sort of classic U.S. Story has been the Glasgow, Kentucky, where the municipal entity early on started providing a variety of telecommunication services along with water and other municipal utilities.
Mr. Chairman, it's an interesting concept, and Steve, it's not a trick question. It's a thoughtful one, because as we ponder how this moves ahead, there are other philosophical questions, like if we end up investing in fiber, we as a government, as people, will we end up shooting ourselves in the other foot by disincentivizing the next technological leap, for instance, or are we going to agree there's some basic level of service that we're going to lock into now that, anyhow, it's just, it'd be a fun one to bat over an adult beverage some evening if you want to invite me down to Seven Herms.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, some of these conversations do require appropriate lubrication. But,
Mr. Chair, what's our committee budget?
there are difficult questions around this. In the 1990s, the state of Iowa made a decision to, as a state, provide the network linking its schools and libraries across the state. So you had this state-owned network, and one of the, you know, certainly the telecom providers were opposed to that, but it was reflecting the public interest in this common good, which was the provision of education. Mm-hmm. And as technology changed, one of the concerns was, did the Iowa network keep pace? While that was happening, the legislature in the 1990s made a conscious decision to not go that route when we did the telecommunications access grants, and to instead use that state purchasing power to encourage local providers to invest in their local capacity in greater Minnesota. So, you know, I think given the diversity across the state, there are real policy challenges for the state being in the telecom business. I think there's a distinction to be drawn with respect to local or county governments as we think about how to try to make this work in a very diverse, you know, economic and population environment.
Any follow-up? Representative Lilly? Representative Berry, you want to go first? Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking as Senator Kelly, Mr. Kelly has talked about this, that Scott and Dakota County, and Representative Mason, maybe you're familiar with this too, the, built a high-speed fiber optic network that loops the two counties with St. Paul for educational and governmental purposes at first, but it's so overbuilt that I believe they have entertained or encouraged private companies to buy some of the excess bandwidth. And I mean, not just the capacity from one town to the next, but alternate routes should somebody sever a cable or something like that. There's a lot of redundancy built in. In something where they, the two counties decided to take that plunge now, and I think they're opening it up for other purposes as well as they can, using it as an economic development tool. Just some random thoughts that are occurring to me as we're pondering this.
Representative Mason?
When we're talking about broadband and internet and a global economy, certainly broadband, we know there's a lot of competition in other countries, they're doing better. Is there a model globally that you think we should be looking at, and is it typically more government or more private in the other countries?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, I think one has to be careful about looking at other country models. For example, people look at Japan and Korea. I certainly think that the United States ought not lose ground economically or in infrastructure terms, but it's also important to bear in mind that the cost structure in those two relatively small, very densely populated countries, we shouldn't, that there's a cost difference in the United States, you know, as we try to figure out how we're going to serve a big country with areas that are very sparsely settled, they don't have a counterpart in some of the countries that people use as models. So I do think we ought to make some choices about, are we going to keep our infrastructure at that same capacity? But when we do that, we also have to be mindful that there are real differences. You know, Singapore, people point to for a variety of purposes, including education and telecommunications, but it's a city-state. It's, you know, there's no corresponding 7th Congressional District or Wyoming in terms of the distances that have to be covered. So, so a distance does relate to cost.
Thank you.
Representative Louie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Kelly. In your presentation, you mentioned some thoughts going on with regards to franchise fees. I wonder if you could give us a little preview of your study that you're going to come out later this month or
yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly, the issue is at which level should access to the cable TV market be regulated? It isn't. Like around 2000, I introduced a bill that called for having the state collect the franchise fees. That was a mistake. So I think any reasonable statewide franchise bill is going to preserve to the local units of government the franchise fee. The issue is really going to be around the area served, and particularly the question of how rapid a build-out would happen. And among the questions raised is, would a new entrant invest in areas that have a relatively large number of low-income folks? And so the issue of redlining has arrived. And there are some models. California chose an interesting thing. I haven't looked at the bill in a while, so I can't give you the specifics, but they basically adopted a kind of rough proportional thing that as a telephone company entered the cable TV market, or some other kind of entrance came into the cable TV market, they had to be balanced between low-income communities and middle-income or upper-income communities in their investments, and they provided a mechanism for overseeing that. So there are ways of addressing some of those concerns. Another issue is this. Cable commissions that across multiple city boundaries are good things. But they came together by accident. You know, they're a legacy. Now, if the ruling in that cable commission is that a new entrant has to build out all of the cities that are in that commission at the same time, that's not necessarily a market, a logical market entity to pay attention to. It's an accidental conglomeration of cities. It's a legitimate question for which there are arguments on both sides. But the larger that entity is and the higher the build-out requirement, the greater the barrier to entry for a new company to create competition. I mean, those are just, you know, in the metropolitan area is a significant challenge. There are many communities in greater Minnesota that have competitive video, that have competitive triple play providers that metro area customers don't have. And one of the reasons for that is that a regional center is a smaller marketing entity. And, you know, the really easy comparison is the difference between a state house race in Park Rapids versus one in North St. Paul. Representative Saylor can afford to buy airtime because it's a smaller market. You, Representative Lilly, have to buy the metro area price, which is reaching almost 3 million people. And so a company trying to think about entering the metropolitan market has got some big marketing challenges, both and challenges in terms of trying to build out and then how do I promote the availability of this new service. So I think those are some of the reasons that there's this difference between certain greater Minnesota regional centers and the metro area.
Great. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kelly, and being aware of the time here, we do want to move out here by 10 o'clock. Again, we're going to have the information that Mr. Kelly provided emailed to you, so you can take a look at it once again, and thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. We've got some folks from the PUC here. They're going to say a little bit about their regulatory role in the telecommunication world. Welcome, Mr. Hart. Welcome, Mr. Overlander. If you'd identify yourself for the record and go ahead. You probably have 15 minutes or so. Is that going to work for you?
That should be fine if we can get this, get my slides out here. Okay, well. Mr. Chair, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. With me is Mark Oberlander, who is the manager of the telecommunications unit in the Commission. We're going to give you a brief overview of the role of the Commission, sort of how it's structured, and kind of hit the high points on the extent of our regulatory authority in the telecommunications area, and hopefully this will supplement the very fine presentation you just received from Senator Kelly. Commission primary responsibility is to regulate the rates and services for three critical services in Minnesota: electricity, natural gas, and local telephone service. The basic mission is to provide safe, adequate, and reliable service at fair and reasonable rates. Commission has several divisions. We have a couple of units that focus on energy issues, energy rates, and then also energy facilities. It's responsible for approval of large energy facilities in Minnesota. We have the telecommunications unit that Mr. Oberlander is in charge of. We have a legal unit that's primarily responsible for preparation of our orders, which is the means by which the Commission expresses its decisions. And, we like to say the Commission speaks through its orders, so the order preparation part of our operation is very, very important as well. We have a consumer affairs office that deals with consumer problems, billing problems, service problems, telephone, electricity, natural gas, all of those. And then we have an administrative management unit that keeps everything moving. We have five commissioners. There's certain criteria in statute that the governor who appoints them needs to bear in mind in making the appointments. So they are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They have 6-year staggered terms. Currently, our chairman is David Boyd, Dr. David Boyd. Our vice chair is Phyllis Reha, and our other commissioners are Tom Pugh, Dennis O'Brien, and Betsy Wood. The commission is structured with a significant degree of independence. It's a quasi-judicial body, so it has a significant degree of independence, so that it's able to function in a way that makes well-reasoned, well-informed decisions. I've listed here some of the aspects of that independence. It can be removed only for cause. No more than three commissioners from any one party at the time. Currently, we have three Republicans and two Democrats, and at least one commissioner must be from outside of the metro, Twin Cities metro area. As I said, the commission is a quasi-judicial body, also has some legislative responsibilities. That mainly takes the form of rulemaking. The commission has responsibility for establishing rules that govern the activities of all firms in an industry, but also a large part of what the commission does is dealing with cases specific to certain companies. Right now, for example, we have several large rate cases from electricity and natural gas companies. We have petitions for large energy facilities. We have complaints dealing with telecom issues that are specific to companies, and in that respect, the commission functions in a quasi-judicial body. Commissioners are subject to a specific code of conduct, and I've listed here just a few of them, some of the major ones. Meetings must be open to the public. All deliberations are done in public. There are specific requirements dealing with conflict of interest, employment restrictions, and provisions regarding ex parte communications. Turning then to the commission's authority in telecom, as Mr. Kelly mentioned and covered in more detail, there has been a policy change in telecommunications, occurred largely in the 1990s. I've oversimplified it, I'm sure, but basically it was a movement from sort of traditional regulation, which had been the case up until that point, to a greater reliance on markets. The Telecom Act of 1996 at the federal level that Senator Kelly mentioned was a very significant event in that process. There were also measures taken here at the Minnesota legislature along the same lines, but the movement, the thrust, has been to move telecom more towards a greater reliance on markets and less regulatory oversight. The Commission's authority in Minnesota relates mainly to landline telephone companies, large and small. In Minnesota, landline companies have an option of either sort of the traditional rate of return regulation, where they would come in for rate proceeding and go through the whole process, or an alternative form of regulation, or sometimes called A4, where they present a plan and that is reviewed by the commission, and that plan allows them significantly greater pricing flexibility for certain kinds of services, allows them to be more responsive in the marketplace. But still, there are some limits on price flexibility on certain basic services. And each plan is sort of unique, you know, to each of the companies. And then there are competitive local exchange companies and inter-exchange companies, which are the long-distance companies. They are regulated as telecommunications carriers, and that's sort of yet another category. By the way, I should have mentioned at the outset that in your packet there should also be a handout, an outline that Mr. Oberlander prepared on the history and evolution of telecommunications regulations in Minnesota, and that provides a little more detailed background on some of these topics I'm just sort of skimming over here this morning. There are several categories of service that the PUC does not regulate. Probably important to understand that as well. Cellular or satellite telephone service or paging services, coin phones, pay phones, which you don't see too many of anymore these days, but there's still a few out there. Telephone services in hotels or restaurants. Internet or internet service providers are not regulated by the PUC. Cable television, as Senator Kelly talked about, is handled largely at the local level. And then I've termed it mobile voice over internet protocol services. Mr. Oberlander reminded me that really should be nomadic voice over internet protocol. That's the buzz term, I guess, as opposed to facilities-based. But nomadic voice over internet telephone voice over internet protocol services are not subject to PUC. The facilities-based services are still somewhat in question. Not sure why this is lacking out all the time. Also, the Minnesota statutes provide several goals for the commission to be aware of and to observe in carrying out their duties as a regulatory body, and I've just listed those goals here: universal service, just and reasonable rates, encouraging economically efficient deployment of infrastructure, fair and reasonable competition for telephone service in a competitively neutral manner, improving quality of service, customer choice, customer protection as we transition from a more regulated type of environment to a more competitive market-based environment, and also encouraging voluntary resolution of issues between competing parties. So that provides you a very quick overview of what we do, how we're structured, and sort of the very broad parameters of our authority in telecommunications. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, or actually a couple quick questions. What percentage of the PUC's time would you say is spent on telecom and telecom issues?
I'll answer, it this way. We have typically somewhere around 2,000 filings every year. It varies from year to year. It's gone as high as 2,200, 2,300, but that's normally the ballpark. The vast majority of those are telephone filings. However, many of those are fairly routine. So in terms of the amount of time that the commission spends, the commission itself actually spends, it's probably half and half, maybe 60-40 energy, telecom. I haven't calculated that recently, but that's, I think, a good estimate.
Thank you.
I'm happy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the PUC do anything with cable telephone service? Is there any regulation there if one of my neighbors gets phone service from Comcast?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have no.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Haar referred to that earlier in his overview that he provided. As he stated, the federal courts have ruled that nomadic VoIP service, that is the VoIP service that you can plug into from anywhere around the world, that is not subject to state regulatory jurisdiction. But that court ruling did not address the issue. May states regulate telephone service provided over cable or any other fixed facilities? So that is still an open legal question. Right now it's largely being addressed in courts and at the federal level, but that is one of the very current and important issues that needs to be addressed in the near future.
One more short
that's
one.
Not happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then how about wireless phone service?
Mr. Chair and representatives, by statute, radio common carriers, which include cellular and paging, any service provided over the radio waves is not under the jurisdiction of the Minnesota PUC. Mm-hmm. Wireless carriers are largely regulated at the federal level by the FCC.
Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Oberlander, Senator Kelly referenced some cities that may own their telephone lines. What cities are those?
Representative Johnson and other representatives, to the best of my memory, and I would need to check to be 100% sure, but I believe it may be Cross Lake and Barnesville.
It seems to be the collective opinion of the people in the room here, so we have to check to make sure.
Very good. And Mr. Oberlander, what do you see as big issues or trends that are on the horizon in telecom world right now that may affect us here in Minnesota? In brief.
Yes. Chairman Johnson and representatives, a lot of the current activity in front of the commission is still to work out interconnection issues between companies. With the advent of competition and multiple providers in the network, we want customers of one company to be able to make phone calls to companies of other customers. That means that their networks have to be interconnected so they can hand off calls from one company to the other company. And those interconnections have a lot of technical details that need to be worked out and coordinated. Some situations might arise where the company says, my system has these technical requirements, the other company has different technical requirements, and they say, you change your system to be compatible with mine. The majority of those issues get worked out, but when the companies can't work them out, they bring the issue to the commission. The commission takes the formal evidence, has hearings, and makes decisions on issues like that. There are other issues, for example, when companies exchange traffic, what should the payment arrangements be between the companies? So there's a large number of technical and economic issues that need to be addressed to make sure that we have a working integrated system.
Very good, Madam Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this would be for either of you. I'm just wondering how you resolve what could be a potential conflict between some of your stated goals, the one of supporting universal service and a third one of encouraging economically efficient deployment of infrastructure.
Well, Dr. Hart?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Saylor. The Commission's role in many regards is one of balancing of interests, so that is one that you cited certainly an example where that is required. And universal service has been a longstanding goal of telecommunications policy and is one that the Commission has certainly tried to promote. One of the things that I might mention in that regard is the fact that the Commission is also responsible for oversight of the telephone assistance program, which goes a long ways towards providing making sure that telephone services are affordable for households in that regard. But I mean, it is a difficult task. There are also economic realities that Mr. Oberlander mentioned, Senator Kelly mentioned too, in terms of delivering these services in various areas. There are different cost factors to deal with, the question is, what is economically efficient? What's the best level of investment given densities and population, the expectation of customers? All of those factors have to be taken into the calculus in arriving at those decisions, and those are very difficult decisions to make. But certainly the overriding goal is to make sure that our economy is healthy, as healthy as it can be, and telecommunications plays a critical role in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and folks, I really appreciate your being here today and the good service you do. But one of my questions is, when you mentioned interconnectivity, have you considered, or maybe you already have, to do it on a case-by-case basis, but a task force or something to set standards for that? That seems like it would facilitate the whole process.
Mr. O'Rourke?
Chairman Johnson and Representative Kissmeyer, the interconnection obligations and the state PUC rules are set out in the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. So both the industry and the commission are bound to carry out the duties and procedures established in federal law. And each company's network and cost structure and management philosophy is different. At the end of the day, these details have to be worked out on a company-to-company basis, although there are protections built into the law that basically say that an arrangement available for one company or an agreement reached between two companies, another company can adopt those same terms and conditions. So the current system is both, you know, a mix of being able to work out a unique arrangement that works best for the two companies, or you can adopt an agreement that other companies have worked out.
All right. Thank you for your testimony,
Thank you,
Mr. Orlander, Dr. Haar. And we know you're available for further questions as they arise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And on our agenda, we have some folks from NACTA. Ms. Miller, if you want to come on up and identify yourself for the record. And is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify or say a few words, or is this it? Looks like this could be it, so you have the remaining minutes to say what you will.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Try to keep it to about 5 minutes. So, my name is Jody Miller, and I am with the State Trade Association called NACTA. We do have a one-page handout that shows you a brief paragraph about us and a list of our membership. I'm the legislative co-chair for this organization, and we have over 100 members. As you can see, it is a statewide organization, and we represent communities all across the state and a very diverse range of sizes and shapes and so forth. And we have cities, cable commissions, community cable television stations, and some nonprofit organizations among our members. We've been in existence 27 years, and we came into being about the same time that cable television came into the state of Minnesota. And of course, at that time, cable companies were building coaxial video networks that were serving just analog video services. And as has already been mentioned, now we are working with large international corporations that are providing the, quote, triple play cable TV, internet, and telephone services, and offering digital and over fiber networks. I am an employee of the NDC-4 Cable Commission, which is the Northern Dakota County Cable Communications Commission that's listed there. We have 7 communities in our group cable commission, and we also have a nonprofit cable TV station called Town Square Television. If you go to our website, townsquare.tv, you can see a lot of information about what we do and the local programming that we produce. I thought if I just took 2 minutes to tell you a little bit about what I do at my job, it's a fairly good representation of what all of our members do across the state. Even though they are very unique in size and budget and shape, and each community has kind of created their system uniquely to serve their community's best needs. Our cable commission is the franchise regulator of cable in our community, and we have a local franchise with Comcast. We work under an umbrella of federal and state law, so we do have consistent regulations and laws that we apply. But then we have our local franchise, which was negotiated specifically with Comcast. We are the consumer complaint office for the cable customers in our area, and our telephone number is listed on the cable bill. So if a customer has a complaint, we are the place that they can call. And we do answer the phone when they call, and we represent the consumers individually and help get their problems resolved. We do regulate. Still, even though deregulation has been continuing over the last 15 years or so, but we do regulate basic one cable rates. Many people are not aware that there is a basic one service that's available for about $15, and that has about 28 channels, including our 7 community peg channels and the broadcast networks and a few other cable channels. We are also able to regulate customer service. Many people don't realize that the cable company is required to answer the phone in 30 seconds or less 90% of the time. And we feel that because we are able to franchise locally, we have had some influence in maintaining local call centers here in the state of Minnesota that are employing many, many people. And having local bill paying offices in our community where you can go and pick up a box or pay your bill. Our franchise requires that that exists in our seven city area. And then probably the more exciting thing that we do is I'm the executive director for Town Square Television, and we are the local community cable station for the area. Last year in 2008, we produced about 1,500 new programs that showed on our seven local channels. And we did, we do many different kinds of programming, city council meetings, high school sports, services, fundraisers for our local charities and so forth. But one of our biggest roles that you may be familiar with is the coverage of election season in our communities. And in 2008, we carried over 10 hours of locally produced candidate forums, debates, and meet the candidates segments. And then on election night, we do a three-hour live program. We had 35 to 40 candidates stopping in to thank their voters and supporters on the air that night, and then also we carry the results so that the citizens in our community can get up-to-the-minute results on election night. And a couple of other things that we have done recently: in June of 2008, we implemented web streaming. So now if you go to townsquare.tv, you can see many of our cable programs on the internet. And we do carry live city council meetings and other live programs on the internet, and then archive those, and they're also available for replay. The meetings are indexed and searchable, so it's really nice for citizens because you can go and look for a topic or look for a particular meeting and zoom right in and also see the supplementary documents that are attached to that issue. And as was already mentioned today, the Institutional Network, or INET, many of our MACTA members are involved with some kind of a community network that allows the school districts, cities, counties, libraries, etc., to have high-speed connections on fiber that are usually enabled through the cable franchise in some way. Our system has 40 buildings, and it really was a private-public partnership with Comcast, because those 40 buildings paid about $20,000 each for the construction of the fiber, and then they had 15 years use of that dark fiber. So that is part of how the Dakota County network that was mentioned earlier, some pieces of that network are through the INET, and then some are actually owned by the county. And then finally, we do have a parent organization called NATOA. It's also mentioned on the top of the page that we handed out, and that's the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, and provides us with a lot of information about what's going on across the country and in other states, and we do have a good electronic network and monthly conference calls so that we are keeping up with what's going on all over the country. So we're just here to offer ourselves as a resource to the committee. We're very interested in the work that you're doing, obviously, and we welcome any of you to contact me or contact our office, and one of our members would be happy to provide you with any information throughout the session.
Thanks for your comments.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller, left-hand beer.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. Miller, it's good to see you again. You mentioned a moment ago that I think it was in the NBC before that you worked for. You had mm-hmm. seven public channels. I know in Shakopee we've got three and one, the PEG channel plus channel six. Could you talk about the seven that you have, and just for the new members, tell us how Metro Channel 6 fits into the picture. Can you do that?
Sure. Representative Beard, in our system, we've kind of categorized our channels by topic areas, and one of the reasons we have two government channels is because we do carry government meetings for four of our bigger suburbs, plus school boards and others. So we have to dedicate two channels just for the government meetings and all the government-related programming. But each community is free to set up their systems as they see as the best fit for their community. But in our case, we do have one public access channel that is available for the citizens to submit programming. Mm-hmm. And we have a second public access channel that is dedicated for multi-faith programming. And that just happens to be in our community. We have an extremely high usage of the multi-faith channel. We have It's multi-denominational, and we even have an atheist program that is carried there. But we have about 14 or 15 new programs every week that are coming in from these various groups. And then we have an education channel for the K through 12 and the local community college to use. So that's 1, 2, public, multi-faith. We have a community channel where we carry all of our staff-produced news, sports, and community event programming. And then we have a 24-hour bulletin board channel that carries announcements for anyone in the community that wants to put up information. That's starting to be tied to our website now, so we can promote graphics, you know, simple messages that are very efficient to put on. As far as Channel 6, it's totally a separate entity. It's a metro-wide regional channel. It was established under the state statute when the Chapter 238, I believe, was enacted. And it does receive some funding from the state, I believe. And then the purpose of it is to have one channel that all of us can distribute our programming, and it's received metro-wide across the entire Minneapolis-St. Paul area. We purchase a time slot on that channel, and so a Thursday night from 7 to 8 p.m., you would see Town Square Television programming on that channel, but it carries a wide range of programming from many different sources.
Very good. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard, I just had two quick things here. One of them had to do with when Senator Kelly was discussing, and others as well, that the rural issues are important. And one of the things that I became aware of was that in Europe, landlines are very difficult there because of the mountains, and they have other challenges, somewhat similar to sometimes us in the USA, a large thing. And so they were kind of trying to work along, then wireless came in. They just skipped the whole landline thing and just said, we'll just do wireless. And so sometimes the nimbleness of the of that going along, sometimes the nimbleness of the local and the small and the amount of new programming and the access thing that people have through things like this are tremendous. I mean, otherwise, new things have a hard time breaking into the big market, but this provides real access and grassroots basis. But also, I think I'd like to... I don't know if we have it on the schedule, maybe the rural telecom. I think there isn't there an association or something of rural.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd like to hear about that. If it's not scheduled, since we seem to be in that mode of doing that, that seems like.
That's a good point, Representative Kiffmeyer. They're invited, but they're unable to be here today, so we'll make a point of making sure they
great.
Get
good
the opportunity
to,
to give their 2 cents.
Sure.
Well, if there's no further questions, I think we're close to 10 o'clock, and thank members for your attention and everyone for being here.
Meeting adjourned.